To entitle this talk. The Speechless Full Moon. I'll start with a little prologue. Inside this new love, die. Your way begins on the other side. Become the sky. Take an axe to the prison wall. Escape. Walk out like someone suddenly born into color. Do it now. You're covered with thick cloud. Slide out the side. Die. And be quiet. Quietness is the sure sign that you have died. Your old life was a frantic running from silence. The speechless full moon comes out now. So in some ways, this very brief poem, whether you could read it at least the way I do, it describes the path of moving from the path of compulsion, suffering, endless searching and becoming, to the realization of freedom, to the end of the search, the end of running. Remember in that passage, your old life was an endless running from silence. Speechless full moon comes out now. So I think this describes the whole of our practice of waking up in the midst of it all, because this path does not depend on circumstances. It depends on slipping out the side and dying. It depends on in any moment realizing in the middle of everything that there is this quiet. Quietness is the sure sign that you've died, the poet says. But the process of coming out of the world and recognizing the whole world of compulsion and living in silence, living in this, recognizing this natural inner quietude it's both instantaneous and it's gradual. And the way that the Buddha expounded in his first teaching tells us of both the means and the end of this process. And it starts with the obvious understanding that the path has something to do with putting our mind, as I said both today and last night, putting our mind in the same location as our body. That clearly, that stopping the compulsions, stopping that endless running from silence, has something to do with orienting ourselves to this unfolding present. And given that our body is what we find in this unfolding present, you cannot separate the path of awakening from discovering and what I would call and what many have called an in-the-body experience, not an out-of-body experience. And in fact, probably one of the most, to me, direct and pithy sutras from the Buddha about the power of putting our mind in the same location of our body is from the Anguttara Nikaya, the numbered discourses of the Buddha, and I actually brought it along today to share with you. This is actually a longer talk, but maybe I'll do part one today, part two tomorrow. Even as one who encompasses with his mind, his or her mind, the mighty ocean includes thereby all the rivulets that run into the ocean. Just so, O nuns and monks, whoever develops and cultivates mindfulness directed to the body includes thereby all the wholesome states that partake of supreme knowledge. One thing, O monks and nuns, if developed and cultivated, leads to the strong sense of urgency, to great benefit, to great security from bondage, to mindfulness and clear comprehension, to the attainment of vision and knowledge, to a pleasant dwelling in this very life, to the realization of the fruit of knowledge and liberation. What is that one thing? It is mindfulness directed to the body. If one thing, O monks, is developed and cultivated, the body is calmed. The mind is calm. Discursive thoughts, quietened, and all wholesome states that partake of supreme knowledge reach fullness of development. What is that one thing? It is mindfulness directed to the body. If one thing, O monks, is developed and cultivated, ignorance is abandoned. Supreme knowledge arises. Delusion of self is given up. And you can think of this as moment to moment, too. Think of it as so ultimate. Delusion of self is given up. Underlying tendencies are eliminated, and the fetters are discarded. What is that one thing? It is mindfulness directed to the body. A little more, I'll keep going since I don't get this. Perhaps you don't read this so often. They do not partake of the deathless who do not partake in mindfulness directed to the body. They partake of the deathless who partake of mindfulness directed to the body. The deathless is lost to those who have lost mindfulness directed to the body. Not lost is the deathless to those who have not lost mindfulness directed to the body. They will fail to reach the deathless who fail in mindfulness directed to the body. They do not neglect the quest for the deathless who do not neglect mindfulness directed to the body. They forget the deathless who forget mindfulness directed to the body. They do not forget the deathless who do not forget mindfulness directed to the body. They are undeveloped in the quest for the deathless who are undeveloped in mindfulness directed to the body. They are developed in the quest for the deathless who are developed in mindfulness directed to the body. They have not comprehended the deathless who have not comprehended mindfulness directed to the body. They have comprehended the deathless who have comprehended mindfulness directed to the body. They have not realized the deathless who have not realized mindfulness directed to the body. They have realized the deathless who have realized mindfulness directed to the body. So this sutra comes, I think, to all of us with some appreciation, perhaps, for how much we have abandoned mindfulness directed to the body, abandoned our bodies, and gone out of ourselves, gone into the world of our imagination in search, gone innocently to the world of disconnection for our discovery of freedom, not connection, not that sense of immediacy that comes quite naturally when mindfulness is directed to the body. So when the Buddha talks about the body, he doesn't talk about the idea of the body. He talks about the felt experience of it. In the turning of the wheel of the Dharma, in the first discourse, the Dhammacakka Sutta, most of you know that in the first sutta, the Buddha expounded on the Four Noble Truths. Well, he had a version in a little pithy passage, a version of the Four Noble Truths that I think relates a lot to our practice of putting our mind in the same location of our body. He said, within this fathom-long body, with its perceptions and inner sense, lies the world, lies the cause of the world, the cessation of the world, and the path that leads to the cessation of the world, within this fathom-long body. So this reminds me, at least, that what we usually think of the world is an idea. What we experience moment to moment, what do we experience moment to moment? We experience sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and cognizing, thinking. And essentially that's all. So in this body, this is the world, in fact. In this fathom-long body lies the world. Without this body, there is no perception of what we call the world. There is no outer reality. There is no world in trouble. There is no story of the world, even. So all of what we experience as the world depends on this fathom-long body. But I think that we've, because of the disconnection, because of the lack of mindfulness directed to the body, we've gotten lost in our ideas of the world, but not the world. Whatever you think about the world is not the world. It's just like that classic line from Munindraji where he says, a thought of your mother is not your mother. A thought of the world is not the world. It is marvelous to be able to think of the world, the globe, all its problems, all the inhabitants, and that it can be gladdening to the heart, it can be terrifying, sad, everything. But an idea of the world is not the world. It's a projection. But that projection depends on the world that we experience through this fathom-long body. Lies this world. So the Buddha invited us, you know, in the First Noble Truth, to examine the world. Not to think about it, not so much to reflect on it, but as a living practice to examine the world. In this fathom-long body lies the world. And what he asked for us to do in finding the real world, you know, we think of the real world as, I'm going to leave the retreat and go out to the real world. We have that kind of expression. But the real world is always right here. But what he asked us to discover is, what is the world? And what's it like? He basically led us on a little bit by saying, if you see the world, you will see that world that depends on this fathom-long body is filled, your own life, your own mind, is filled with all kinds of stresses. This is what you will discover. It is filled with the stress of being born, of that process of being born. It is filled with the stresses of having a lot of physical discomfort, getting sick, the stresses of getting old, the stresses of dying, the stresses that your body registers when you don't get what you want, the stresses that your body feels when you don't want what you get, the stresses of being separated from that which you hold near and dear, Did I say dying yet? That along with the fact of birth, in fact, I don't know, most of you have ever heard the Wiley's Dictionary definition of birth? The leading cause of death. But birth is also the leading cause of all the kinds of stresses. That if we truly feel the world, we will know that this is how it is. This is not an aberration. It is not just you. It is not, doesn't mean that something's wrong with you. This is what the world is like. Not just the picture that we have in our mind. That isn't so satisfying. That doesn't really change our hearts to see the world and all its suffering and the picture of it. See what it looks like on TV. It helps a little bit. But what really becomes the cause of all this lofty language of the deathless and the sure heart's release and the calming is what the Buddha recommended, to know it for oneself. Not to adopt any views or beliefs about it, but to see for yourself whether it's true. He suggested that there are basically three kinds of dukkha, or three kinds of things that are difficult to bear, or stresses that you will find. You will find all those garden variety that I just described. You will find the stress of the endless changing nature of our body, what he called anicca dukkha. You'll discover the stress of just having to deal with so much, the sankhara dukkha, just the stress of the relentlessness of the conditions, the relentlessness of the thoughts that come. Have you noticed that today? Isn't it amazing? It's so obvious that there's no agency for these thoughts. That if there was, there would be the elimination of 99% of them. But they come like a flywheel, like a waterfall. And these are the conditions that present themselves. And there's stress in that. And there's stress in the endless conditions of change to our body, even as you sat here today. Sometimes it's nice and smooth like a lake, and other times it's like a rushing river. Sometimes it's just bubbling and boiling. Sometimes it's aching and burning. These are conditions. And the relentlessness of those conditions that come unbidden are stressful to us. So the Buddha asks us in the teachings, invited you to see for yourself whether or not this is true, and to at least experiment, feel it, and then to be able to say, this is true and I have, to a certain degree, welcomed it or opened to it. That's the first truth in this fathom-long body. Lies the world. Did I give all three? Yeah. Dukkha dukkha, anicca dukkha, sankhara dukkha. Three kinds of dukkha. And you can think about the world and all its many, many problems. This is something we can know for ourselves here and now, without reflection. And what helps us understand the universality of it is actually feeling it through the body. We know that if I feel the burning of anger, and I see an angry person, I know what it's like for them. When I feel that intense longing or wanting or dissatisfaction, I automatically connects me with all beings. There is a tendency, however, because of the second noble truth, the cause of the world, to manufacture or incarnate in the version of ourselves where I'm the only one that's having these issues. Everyone else seems to be fine, but I'm the one there's something wrong with me. There's something wrong with this world, first of all. and there's especially there's something wrong with me. Any of you ever have that? And this is where the Buddha spoke about the cause of the world. So all of this happens, both the world, the cause of the world, the end of the world, and the path leading to the end of the world. All of this can be seen here and now. All of this can be seen as happening momentarily. And this is why it is really possible in this very life, in this very moment, to wake up. To wake up and in any moment to come to both realize the end of the world and be at the same time cultivating the path to the end of the world. So he didn't stop with there being all kinds of dukkha or stress or dissatisfaction or that which is hard to bear that we can discover in the body. He said that there's a cause for it. And that cause, the cause of the world, that also depends on this fathom-long body, is the tendency of mind born of simple reactions. Tendency of mind that hardens into a kind of addictive pattern, a compulsive pattern, to want things to be different than the way they are. We all know this. This is Dharma 101. That suffering doesn't have as much to do with what's with the world, but wanting the world to be different. Wanting my experience to be different. Wanting whoever I think I am to be different. And that starts with simple reactions that we can only discover in this fathom-long body. We can see the whole causal relationship for the manufacture of this great world that we feel that we are in, this one small person who is in this big world, being blown by the winds of circumstances. In some way, this is just a story. It doesn't describe anyone who really exists. What we can know is how moment to moment there are these little these moments of contact. Moments of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting. The physical organ, what are we called, the sense bases. And then there is some experience that comes. And this is how it happens moment to moment. This is how the world is created. And that experience, every experience, any experience at any one of the doors of perception produces a feeling tone, comes arising with, based on conditioning, arises with a feeling tone of either pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant or unpleasant. This is how the world is created. When it's pleasant, and it goes unnoticed, it's immediately followed by what? What is the pleasant followed with? Well, it's first followed by liking. But that liking produces a little charge, doesn't it? It's not just liking, we take it for granted, but it produces a little charge. Like it. And the liking, that little charge, when it goes unnoticed, is immediately followed by, you've made the gesture, wanting. Wanting hardens into craving. Craving, then, because that's at that point, craving is a kind of constriction, it's a kind of pressure. That then spawns a kind of compulsion to become, to enter into the world, to create the world of me who has got to somehow end the world's suffering, end the distress of having lost a sense of equilibrium, lost a sense of home. Does this make sense? Does it sound too theoretical? You ever just hear that, smell that, feel that, and all of a sudden you've taken off. You've gone into what we call papancha. Just start proliferating into fantasy of And it could be just the opposite. Something unpleasant produces that charge of not liking, and then not liking is followed by aversion and the craving to get rid of. And pretty soon we've incarnated in we've created the world of this profound drama of becoming the one who's going to get rid of the suffering of the world. All within a flash of a moment. So if you feel confused and stuck in the world, it's just your conditioning. It's been from beginningless time, this has been the cause of the world. This spawning of the search and the state of becoming, the state of trying to have more, to become more, to get rid of, it's been the momentum that's kept us on the wheel of suffering. So the Buddha said, or suggested, that not to just adopt a view, craving causes the world, or craving causes suffering. Just take that on and then make yourself miserable trying not to crave, becoming irritating to yourself and everyone else. But rather, bring attention to this state. That's why I asked you if you were waiting for the bell to ring. Bring attention to the charge that is created when you either don't like something or want something to happen. Bring attention to that. Bring attention, take your attention off of the world that you've created. Bring attention to the state of craving. The objects of the world, the image of the world, are endless. But the same driving cause of the world is this state of craving, wanting things to be different. And the teachings invite us to see whether this is true. Look at it. Look at the state of craving in your mind. And in doing so, in noticing the cause of the world, his recommendation is to abandon the cause, to let go, let it be as it is. And sure enough, I don't know if you've experimented with this, but every time I'm fortunate enough, if that mental factor called mindfulness shows up in the moment of waiting for the bell to ring, every time I have taken the attention gently off of the bell and just let it rest on the mental state of waiting, and then let that awareness expand to feel how that's manifesting in my body, this is what waiting feels like. That waiting, that state of mind, and the physical effect of it reveals itself as this, at least the way I like to think of it, as a weather front that has come into consciousness, moves around for a while, wreaks a little havoc, and then it fades away, just like the Pacific Northwest storms. And you get a great opportunity in the both visual and field and all of that to see how that works. But this is to discover how that weather works internally. Remember, mindfulness is internal and external. If you've read the Satipatthana Sutra, to notice the mindfulness directed to the body internally and externally, and all of its and all the sense stores. So this points to the good news that in this fathom-long body lies the world, lies the cause of the world, and as we notice, as we bring attention to the arising and passing of this intense state of craving or wanting or hoping or expecting or whatever it is, planning, that when it is noticed, we see that that state of craving has a shelf life. It passes away. And then we can see what the Buddha meant, perhaps, when he said, in this fathom-long body lies the world, the cause of the world, and the end of the world. And we haven't, it's not the end of the world, it's not Armageddon, even though some of our creation of the world, this is Rapture Day, everyone. Sorry. You poor suckers. You didn't, you're not true believers. I'm sorry, I shouldn't make rapture jokes. Anybody have a good rapture joke? I'm sorry. With all the love in my heart for a tribal delusion. But we can know for ourselves the end of the world. The cessation, what the Buddha called the cessation of the world, the cessation of suffering. And he recommended, as we explore this fathom-long body, the arising and passing of the and riding the tiger of the craving, hoping, expecting mind, that we can know its cessation and we can say, this has been realized. We have known in real time that there is an end to dukkha. This must be realized. And often at that moment when the speechless full moon comes out, that moment when there is a fading and the acknowledgement of the fading of that, or the loosening of that tight fist of grasping that Gendun Rinpoche talks about, there is a palpable sense of relief. We can know there is an end to the world. So what is the world now when we don't look back and we don't look ahead? When we don't give rise to an idea of ourself in time. And by virtue of practicing in the middle of our daily life, in the midst of it all, by virtue of practicing this mindfulness directed to the body, to the world, to the cause of the world, to the end of the world, we also fulfill the fourth thing that the Buddha said. Within this fathom-long body, with its perceptions and inner sense, lies the world, the cause of the world, the cessation of the world, and the path that leads to the cessation of the world. We realize the fourth noble truth, or at least practice the fourth noble truth, that there is a path. And the center of that path to the end of the world, to the cessation of suffering, is the navigator of that path is mindful attention. And if you can follow that sequence, not turn it into some philosophical idea, some dream of yourself sometime in the span of the mahakalpas finally coming to liberation, and bring it right to what he pointed to this fathom-long body, to moment, seeing how the world gets created and how it fades away, and to moment, keep applying mindful attention to the body. You are fulfilling that path. You're following the path. And you're more likely to, with that sense of presence, more likely to act in ways that are non-harming, work in ways that are non-harming, speak in ways that are non-harming. You're inevitably going to experience the fruits of the continuity of noticing, the fruits of the continuity of connecting and sustaining to the reality of the present moment. And so inevitably you will experience, as you do, whenever you sustain mindfulness directed to the body, you will experience that calm abiding, that sense of collectedness, the sense of finding a home, at least temporarily, free of, more often, free of the inundation with the the hindrances of wanting things to be different than the way they are. And you inevitably will, with your increased sense of composure and concentration, mindfulness, you will start to feel that reality, that the present, as Sri Nisargadatta says, the present is incredibly vital. So different from past and future, which are merely mental, kind of dream world, the world that we create in our mind. That the present is quite vital, and our energy becomes, we recover our vital energy. This is the wise effort. We find that balance of energy and effort. We develop wise concentration, that sense of composure. We develop wise mindfulness. And through that process, we, in every moment, we realize, we, without necessarily knowing it, obviously, cognitively, we see through, we experience what the effect is of seeing through the self-illusion. We start discovering ourselves as that intimate, contingent being that is not apart from anything, that both is fed by the world and fed by others and feeding others, and that there, that our view of self, rather than become deleted or gone, it expands to include all the connection with everything. We find our home in this experience, but that direct experience of the world, not the idea of the world. It's that same experience, maybe it's just me, but the same experience that I have when I'm sitting here with you and I'm not thinking about yesterday or tomorrow. I'm not thinking about myself. I'm just here with you. And in those moments that I'm just here, in that simple momentary presence, I cease to be, until I divide it with an I thought, I can't find any separation between us. I find my home with you. I find that I can't find the dividing line. Unless I create a world again of me and you. And I do create a world of me and you. And that's okay, but I've seen what's beyond that world. So we don't get rid of the idea of me and you. But we see that it's not the whole truth. We step beyond this illusion of separateness. We realize, as Kala Rinpoche says, you live in illusion and the appearance of things. There is a reality. You are that reality. When you understand this, you'll see that you're nothing. But being nothing, you're everything. That's all. Or as Nisargadatta puts it, love tells me I'm everything. Wisdom tells me I'm nothing. Between these two, my life flows. So our wise understanding of this interbeing, of interconnectedness, of the contingent nature of everything, dawns when we cultivate the path here and now. We step beyond the idea of the world and discover the world. And out of that comes, intuitively, inevitably, comes wise intention. Intention of renunciation, of non-harming, of non-greed, non-hatred. An intention to act and live in a way, practice in a way that appreciates the non-separateness of everything, and it becomes the cause of our practice to be of benefit. Somebody asked the question last night, well, if you see that everything is impermanent, I forgot, does anybody remember the question from last night? Everything is impermanent. What's the point of it? What's the point of everything's changing? The point is compassion. The point is it's the only thing we can do, that the natural expression of a heart or mind that is awake is what flows naturally from that is love and caring and hopefully wise, more wise action. So I just want to back up a little bit, since we have a few minutes, to the cause of the world. And this is what we can... I appreciate that I think everyone can appreciate that we can, in any moment, experience the end of the world, where that moment where the speechless full moon comes out now. Do you know what I mean by that? Do you know what that where things are just in their suchness, in their isness, whatever that is. But we often don't experience the suchness or the isness of the wanting mind, of the mind that wants things to be different. When in fact, the very knowing of that, or as the Buddha put it, the abandoning of that through letting it be, letting it go. This is really our practice, is to treat even those moments where our mind is creating the world, creating a problem that needs to be solved. Even that can be your dharma door, can be your manure of bodhi, your fertilizer of your awakening. And so it's, I think, especially useful why we do practice like this, is to become more skilled at being able to incorporate and use those moments rather than as a cause of delusion, use them as a cause of our freedom, as our path. So why it's so useful to watch the way our mind spins, how it creates the world, how it creates the next shopping spree. And we can notice it in a larger way, how the advertising machine tries to seduce you into making the world and the next shopping spree and creating the drama of you getting to somehow fulfill your next purchase. I just happened to bring along my new cynical example of using our deep yearnings for the purpose of encouraging us to shop. This one, the title of the caption, it says Vanquility. You know what that's about? Bask, it says. Bask in the serene glow of the all-new Honda Odyssey. With its spa-like interior, people and cargo live in peaceful harmony. A third row folds down with a single effortless touch. Available Bluetooth centers your focus on the road ahead, while a perfectly balanced 28 highway MPG V6 takes you on a journey of pure van bliss. Introducing the all-new Honda Odyssey, like no van before. It has the Honda Odyssey next to a couple of deer. Not so subtle. This is from Hawaiian Airlines. This year, why not trade acquisition for excursion? Instead of accumulating things, try collecting travel experiences. Your memories will outlast almost anything you own. Plus, they'll never wear you out or take up too much space. It's just endless. But we can... I like these in a way, because the more I read things like this, it's painful on one hand, because not everybody is awake to the game. But if I'm awake to the game, I can keep a sense of humor about the wanting mind. I can see the way I and everyone else is inculcated from the time we're born with this idea that the idea that to have that the name of the game is to both have and fulfill ceaseless desires. And then, as you know, Bolozov puts it, to that have that life where we're endlessly trying to keep up with the Joneses. And he says that it's time that we understand that the Joneses are not happy. But this is something we can see, and in the seeing we do abandon. So we see the cause of the world, we see the end of the world, and by virtue of doing that we cultivate the path to the end of the world. I think that I think I'll end with a small caption of a poem from Hafiz. I'll give you the whole poem tomorrow. But the caption of the poem, the little part of the poem says, "Learn to recognize the counterfeit coins that may buy you a moment of pleasure, but then drag you for days like a broken man behind a farting camel." May all beings know the world, the cause of the world, the end of the world, and the path leading to the end of the world. May all beings be free, and may our practice be dedicated to the welfare and benefit, freedom of all beings.